This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents The End of Overeating, Taking Control of the Insatiable American Appetite by David A. Kessler, M.D. Read by Blair Hardman. Introduction. You are the target.
I've learned to recognize overeating in restaurants all over America. It's not hard, because people who've been conditioned to overeat behave distinctively. They attack their food with a special kind of gusto. I've seen them lift their forks, readying their next bite, before they've swallowed the previous one. And I've watched as they reach across the table to spear a companion's French fries or the last morsel of someone else's dessert. Certain foods seem to exert a magical pull on them, and they rarely leave any on their plates. As I watch this kind of impulsive behavior, I suspect a battle may be taking place in their heads, the struggle between I want and I shouldn't, between I'm in charge and I can't control this. In this struggle lies one of the most consequential battles we face to protect our health. The End of Overeating was born as I watched the Oprah Winfrey Show. Dr. Phil, the program's former resident psychologist, was talking about why people are obese and what they have to do to lose weight. When he asked for a volunteer from the audience, a large, well-dressed woman named Sarah came forward. Resting his hand on her shoulder, Dr. Phil asked Sarah to talk candidly about the self-defeating behavior that, he insisted, led to weight gain. He said he wanted to know what made her do what you know you don't want to do. At first, Sarah was all smiles as she told her story. "I eat all the time," she said with a nervous giggle. "I eat when I'm hungry, I eat when I'm not hungry, I eat to celebrate, I eat when I'm sad, I eat at night, I eat when my husband comes home." Dr. Phil pressed Sarah to describe how she felt about herself. The sunny visage began to change as she confessed to feeling like a failure. Sarah called herself fat and ugly, and said her actions often left her disappointed, frustrated, and angry. "I feel that I can't accomplish what I set up my mind to do. I feel that I can't do it, that I don't have the willpower." Choking back tears, she described how her focus sometimes turned obsessively to her eating behaviors. "My whole thought is about why I eat, what I eat, and when I eat, and with whom I eat," she said. "I don't like myself." Turning to the audience, Dr. Phil asked, "How many of you here related to something you heard?" About 2/3 of its members raised their hands. Sarah's struggle obviously struck a familiar chord in a lot of people. In fact, it struck one in me. One afternoon, I decided to conduct an experiment that pitted temptation against willpower. I walked into a bakery in San Francisco and asked for 2 semi-sweet chocolate chip cookies. Back home, I pulled the cookies out of their bag and placed them on a paper plate, just beyond my arm's reach. They were thick and gooey. Chunks of chocolate filled the craters of the cookies and rose into peaks. I focused my attention on them, monitoring my own response. I sighed deeply and bit my lower lip. Almost indifferent to the flowers on the table and even to the framed photos of my children on the counter, I was fixated on those cookies until I forced myself to pull away. At some point, I noticed that I'd moved my right hand a few inches closer to them, but I had no conscious recollection of my decision to act. I tried to concentrate on reading the newspaper, but I kept glancing back to the plate. Feeling vaguely uneasy, I headed to my upstairs office, which is about as far away from the kitchen as I can get. But even from that safe distance, I could not fully shake the image of the cookies. Eventually, I left the house without having eaten them, and I felt triumphant. Hours later, I headed to Cafe Greco, a North Beach institution where the cappuccino is said to be the best in the city. A large glass jar filled with homemade cookies sat on the counter. I ordered an orange chocolate cookie and ate it at once. I set out to understand what is driving these kinds of behaviors. I wanted to know why Sarah couldn't stop eating, even though doing so made her miserably unhappy and jeopardized her health. I wanted to know why my determination could so easily collapse. I was intent on learning what could be done to help Sarah, me, and the millions of people just like us. I began to listen more closely to people struggling with weight problems, listening the way a doctor needs to listen. I watched as well, paying close attention to how they behaved around food. It soon became clear that Sarah was not alone. My conversation with a journalist, a 40-year-old man I'll call Andrew, reminded me that the struggle respects neither gender, nor socioeconomic class, nor age. Andrew, who is about 5 feet 9 inches tall and weighs about 245 pounds, has written fearlessly from many of the world's battlegrounds. He has spent time with jihadists, suicide bombers, and war-hardened soldiers, and he hasn't flinched. But when I placed M&Ms on the table before him, Andrew felt barely able to cope. When I'm in a meeting or interviewing someone and there's food on the table, I'll spend half my time thinking about that food, he admitted. His internal dialogue seesaws between, "Man, that looks good. I could eat that," and, "I'm not going to eat that because I don't need it." His conflict begins early in the day and never lets up. I wake up in the morning knowing that food is my enemy and that I am my own enemy, he observed. It's uncontrollable. At lunch, Andrew is likely to be tempted by a basket of hot, fresh bread served with butter. On city streets, Starbucks seem to summon him, and at home, his refrigerator beckons irresistibly. "It just goes on and on," said Andrew. Like so many people who have difficulty controlling their eating, he sees food as an obstacle course he must navigate. Andrew finds pharmacies and convenience stores particularly challenging. If he manages to get past the candy aisle without succumbing, he has to stare down more candy at the checkout. In a typical tug of war, Andrew will pick up candy, put it down, then pick it up again, over and over and over. Sometimes he'll win his battle to get out the door without buying the candy, and sometimes he won't. If he does make the purchase, he often feels so disgusted with himself that he'll pour half the contents into the trash and then polish off the rest. He described what he calls his food soundtrack. "When I finished my bowl of Wheaties today, I immediately thought, let me bring a banana and an apple to work so I'm not tempted, so I don't eat that corn muffin downstairs at the office." But any success is momentary and is quickly replaced by further thoughts of food. "I talk to myself," he said. "I'll ask, what am I going to eat for lunch? What if I get hungry at 3? What are we having for dinner? I hope it's good." On a successful day, using maximum restraint, Andrew will consume about 1,500 calories, which is what he wants to eat in order to lose weight. But the next day, he may consume 5,000. He rarely knows when he's full and feels mystified by people who don't share his single-mindedness. "I can comprehend suicide terrorism more easily than I can comprehend somebody who just doesn't think about food," he said, without a trace of facetiousness. Pizza is Andrew's favorite food, and when he smells a hot slice, he's completely distracted. "All I'm thinking about is that pizza," he admitted. "Very little holds my attention the way a pizza holds my attention. I'm telling you, food talks. All food talks." I bet when an addictive gambler walks into a casino, he'll recognize with resignation that he's going to gamble and lose money. I think that recognition makes him upset, but it also makes him exhilarated. Like that gambler, I think that time gets suspended when I walk into a pizza place. Time is suspended. You're not in time anymore. You're not in your own body anymore. I pretend that there are no consequences to my actions. All that exists is me and that pizza. Me and that pizza. That's the feeling. I hadn't planned on tormenting Andrew when I put those M&Ms before him and asked how they made him feel. "They're incredibly distracting," he allowed. "Would eating them make you feel better?" I asked. Andrew said the first taste would give him a rush that was incredibly satisfying. But as he kept popping the candy into his mouth, he knew he would begin to feel ill. More than 10 or 15 M&Ms and it's just too much. It's like the sugar is digging a hole in my stomach. Despite this, he'll keep on eating them. I heard a degree of self-loathing in Andrew as he told his story. The worst thing for me is to be caught in the act of buying M&Ms, he admitted. He'll shove the candy into his pocket as soon as he leaves the cashier, hoping no one will see him. I'm a fat guy, he said, and nobody wants to watch a guy who's overweight eat bad food. They just find it repulsive. How do you feel about yourself after you eat them? I say to myself, there's another loss of control, another 240 calories that I don't need. But all of the rational thoughts in the world can't compete with the color and expectation of an M&M. Nothing else has that kind of power over Andrew, a man accustomed to running his own life. An inanimate object, an inanimate food has power, he said, a hint of disgust in his voice. Andrew recognized the promise of reward embedded in food. It adds color to the day, he said, acknowledging that he feels pulled in by its comfort, stimulation, sedation, happiness, the chance to put fun in the day. America, he said, has become a food funhouse, a carnival of delicious, fatty, salty, sugary, and more to the point, accessible and cheap delights. How could you expect to go to the carnival and not want to go on the rides? It's bright and colorful and fun and exciting. There are all these pings and noises. Of course you want to go on a ride. Of course you want to play the game. Of course you want to spend your money on this stimulation. Do you feel better when you eat? I asked. The funny thing about eating endless amounts is that it's illogical because the feeling is momentary, he said. You can create one more moment of good feeling, but it never lasts. That is a classic description of the body's reward system. The good feeling is ephemeral, but it's what makes the behavior reinforcing, I explained. Because it doesn't last, you want to do it again. I asked Andrew whether he understood why he lost control. That was a total mystery to him. No idea, he answered. He was keen to know why food could hold such power over him. You've been conditioned by food and by cues that remind you of that food, I explained. They focus your attention, promote anticipation, and build desire. I wanted Andrew to realize that many people are wired for food the same way he is, and they're just as likely to lose control. The food industry has been remarkably successful at designing foods to capture the attention of people like him. Food manufacturers, food designers, and restaurant owners may not fully understand the science behind the appeal of their foods, but they know that sugar, fat, and salt sell. As surely as if he were wearing a bullseye on his chest, Andrew is one of the industry's targets. There's no shortage of people who lack control in the face of highly palatable food, and not all of them are overweight. I spoke with a young law student I'll call Samantha. She's 25 years old, 5 feet 6 inches tall, and 120 pounds, but her words could have come from Sarah or Andrew. If food is put in front of me, I find it an eternal struggle not to eat, said Samantha. I hate going to work because they have bowls of candy everywhere. I'll leave my apartment and go to the library to study because we're not allowed to have food there. I keep thinking it would be so easy just to make healthy choices, so why can't I do it? But instead, I rationalize what I eat in the weirdest ways. I have friends who feel the exact same way, and we marvel at people who are not like this. I don't understand how they do it. Samantha stays thin because she doesn't always give in to the pull of food, and she exercises vigorously. But her struggle is feverish, and she's just as frustrated as the overweight people with whom I spoke. As soon as I'm not actively doing something, I'm thinking about what I'm going to eat. These are crazy thoughts to have. When I talk out loud about this, I feel ridiculous. It should not be all-consuming. I'm a smart girl with a lot going on in my life. The fact that I think about food for so many hours every day is maddening. I should be thinking about law school, not about how many Hershey's Kisses I've eaten today. Still another woman, a colleague I'll call Claudia, told a similar tale. What happens when you start to eat? I asked. Sometimes I can't stop. It doesn't happen at every meal, but if there's appealing food in front of me, or I've been thinking about food a lot for some reason, I'll keep eating even to the point of being sick. I encouraged Claudia to share her food memories. "There are days when I dream about food," she said. "I think back to delicious meals I once had and long to feel the same sense of anticipation, happiness, and fulfillment they provoked." Recollections of pleasures past seemed to spill from her. A birthday dinner at the Cheesecake Factory 5 years ago, a perfect late-night slice of New York pizza, and something she called Charlie cookies, a little bar of heaven on earth. Other favorites on her list? Smoothies, corn on the cob, candy bars, potato chips. Some foods were obviously associated with her childhood or happy memories. There was, for example, the pasta sauce she could eat by the spoonful right from the jar, a favorite since age 5. "I crave foods that my father used to make for me and dishes I once had in my college dining hall," she said. Not everything she mentioned would make a nutritionist cringe. Fresh fruit and a great salad got her excited, too. But the common thread was a preoccupied focus on the food she liked. "It's what I think about, what I can't wait to get home to," she admitted. "Left to myself, I will usually eat and eat and eat." "Do you know why you do this?" I asked. "No," she admitted, "I don't." Millions of people are like Sarah, Andrew, Samantha, and Claudia. They don't have any of the eating disorders we've learned to recognize and treat, but food is never far from their minds. And once they begin eating, they can't seem to stop. Long after they've ceased to feel hungry, they're still eating. No one has ever explained what's happening to them and how they can control their eating. That is my goal in this book.
Part 1. Sugar, Fat, Salt. Chapter 1. Something changed. America gained weight.
For thousands of years, human body weight stayed remarkably stable. Throughout adulthood, we basically consumed no more than the food we needed to burn. People who were overweight stood apart from the general population. Millions of calories passed through our bodies, yet with rare exceptions, our weight neither rose nor fell by any significant amount. A perfect biological system seemed to be at work. Then, in the 1980s, something changed. Catherine Flagel was one of the first to recognize the trend, but like many good researchers faced with an unexpected finding, she thought her numbers must be wrong. A senior research scientist at the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Flagel had been studying data from an enormous federal government survey of the health and nutritional status of American households. Her figures indicated that the number of people who were overweight had spiked dramatically. Researchers had never seen such extreme numbers. In earlier decades, American adults typically gained a couple of pounds between the ages of 20 and 40, and then lost a couple of pounds in their 60s and 70s. The shift that riveted Catherine Flagel's attention came from government survey data collected from 1988 to 1991, which revealed that fully one-third of the population, aged 20 to 74, weighed too much. In fewer than a dozen years, 8% more Americans, about 20 million people, roughly the population of New York State, had joined the ranks of the overweight. Her training and professional experience had taught Flagel to be cautious. In a complex and ambitious survey, errors can creep in at many points, and data often show anomalies that disappear with further scrutiny. She knew her information had to be accurate before she sounded an alarm. "We checked it to a fare-thee-well," she said, describing her research team's review of regional analyses, time trends, and quality control techniques. Nothing seemed out of place. The evidence of an abrupt increase in the number of overweight Americans appeared to be valid. Still, she was nervous, especially since no one else seemed particularly aware that Americans as a group were becoming heavier. Hoping to find studies confirming these provocative data, her team scoured the published literature, but few journal articles were relevant. At professional meetings, Flagel casually asked other researchers what they thought was happening with weight in America. Most thought it was the same as it had always been. Americans were gaining millions of extra pounds, yet at first these pounds remained invisible. The medical community, the scientific community, and the federal government were not quick to notice the trend. And so, Flagel's team wrote up its data and went to press. The study, published in the July 1994 issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association, reported that a comparison of current and earlier data on the weight of Americans had revealed dramatic increases in all race and sex groups. When a respected academic journal calls something dramatic, it's the equivalent of a red alert. The results were consistent virtually across the board among men and women, young and old, black and white. The rate of obesity in America had evidently exploded. I asked Catherine Flagel to tell me how average weight had changed over time. Her graphs showed that the population had gotten bigger over the decades. In 1960, when weight was still relatively stable in America, women ages 20 to 29 averaged about 128 pounds. By 2000, the average weight of women in that age group had reached 157. A similar trend was apparent in the 40 to 49-year-old group, where the average weight had jumped from 142 pounds in 1960 to 169 in 2000. Also striking was the evidence that we were entering our adult years at a significantly higher weight, reflecting the gains that had taken place during childhood and adolescence. And from age 20 to age 40, many of us kept gaining. Rather than a few pounds, the average adult man was gaining more than a dozen pounds in those years. Flagel observed something else. While on average, everyone was getting heavier, the heaviest people in the population were gaining disproportionately more weight than others. The spread between those at the upper end of the weight curve and those at the lower end was widening. Weight gain was primarily about overweight people becoming more overweight. What had happened in such a short time to add so many millions of pounds to so many millions of people? Many years of research led me to an unexpected answer. Certainly food had become more readily available in the 1970s and 1980s. We have larger portion sizes, more chain restaurants, more neighborhood food outlets, and a culture that promotes more out-of-home eating. But having food available doesn't mean we have to eat it. What's been driving us to overeat? It is not a want born of fear that food shortages lie ahead. Once this had been so. In the Bible, 7 years of plenty were inevitably followed by 7 years of famine, so we needed to build storehouses of fat in preparation. But in America, where even northern supermarkets are filled with summer fruits much of the year, that logic doesn't apply. Nor is it a want rooted in hunger or the love of exceptional food. That kind of logic is not what's driving the out-of-control eating we see in Sarah, Andrew, Claudia, and so many others like them. We know, too, that overeating is not the sole province of those who are overweight. Even people who remain lean, like Samantha, feel embattled by their drive for food. For them, it takes the most determined restraint to resist what feels like an almost overpowering push to eat. Little help has been available. Family members, friends, and colleagues have not had the knowledge to offer support. Many, including doctors and healthcare professionals, still think that weight gainers merely lack willpower or perhaps self-esteem. Few medical personnel or nutritionists, few psychological experts or public health advocates have recognized the distinctive pattern of overeating that has become widespread in the population. No one has seen loss of control as its most defining characteristic. Those who have succumbed to the pull of food are spending billions of dollars in search of a cure, determined to rid their bodies of the burden of weight. But they are squandering most of their money, finding only short-term weight loss and a vain hope that it will last. That is because we have not understood why eating certain foods only makes us want to eat more of them. No one has recognized what's really happening. Let me try to explain.
Chapter 2. Overriding the Wisdom of the Body.
People get fat because they eat more than people who are lean. I know this seems obvious, but we've spent decades being confused about it. Even now, some people question the link between food consumption and weight gain. But we finally have strong evidence that weight gain is primarily due to overeating. The confusion can be traced, at least in part, to the fact that when people are asked to keep a record of everything they eat, the differences between lean weight and overweight individuals often appear minor. This observation led to all sorts of theories about the primary role that metabolism, diet composition, and genetics might play in weight gain. It was a long time before we realized that the explanation was much simpler. Most people do a poor job of reporting what they eat, and overweight people are particularly inaccurate reporters. So much of our eating takes place outside our awareness that it's easy to underestimate how much food we actually put into our bodies. Sharon Piercy and John DeCastro, both behavioral neuroscientists, compared food intake among a group that had gained more than 5% of its current body weight in the previous 6 months with a group whose weight had not fluctuated significantly during the same period. Participants were armed with a diary and asked to keep comprehensive records of every morsel they ate and every sip of fluid they drank, as well as where, when, and with whom. They also noted how hungry, thirsty, depressed, or anxious they felt before and after each episode of eating. As an added check on accuracy, subjects were given a camera and instructed to photograph their food before and after they ate. A time and date stamp appeared on every picture. The research confirmed that people tend to substantially underestimate their food intake, a finding that was apparent in both groups of study subjects. But it also showed an obvious and dramatic contrast between the two groups. The weight gainers ate an average of almost 400 calories a day more than the comparison group. At that rate, they stood to put on more than 2 pounds every 3 weeks. In another study, scientists monitored the weight gain of a group of children for several years. As it turned out, the weight of their parents and the amount of energy the children burned were less important factors than their caloric intake. The children who ate more weighed more. While vigorous exercise can help control weight, a body of research shows that physical activity levels do not necessarily predict weight gain. More surprisingly, defects in metabolism are not an explanation either. In fact, most studies show that individuals who are obese, officially defined as having a body mass index of 30 or above, or overweight, with a body mass index of 25 or above, burn more energy than their lean counterparts. How much we eat predicts how much we weigh. Sometimes the most obvious explanation turns out to be the right one. For nearly a century, scientists believe humans had biological mechanisms to balance the calories we consume, our energy intake, with the calories we burn, our energy expenditure. This dynamic process was supposed to allow us to maintain a relatively stable amount of fat on our bodies and limit fluctuations in weight. We have presumed that the wisdom of the body is maintained through a feedback system known as homeostasis. Like temperature or blood pressure, which the body also tries to keep within relatively narrow ranges, energy is supposed to be regulated by a homeostatic process that keeps the body's energy stores stable. By closely matching food intake and energy expenditure, this biological strategy has allowed us to consume hundreds of thousands of calories every year without losing or gaining much weight. It's a highly sophisticated system that can be explained simply. Many parts of the body talk to one another. The brain is the command center of an elaborate communications network essential to energy regulation. This network involves the brain, the central and peripheral nervous systems, the gastrointestinal tract, the hormonal system, fat tissue, and more. The brain's hypothalamus receives signals from all these sources, integrates that information, and decides what needs to be done to maintain the body at a steady weight. But this homeostatic system, while relevant, turns out to be less powerful than many scientists have assumed. If we could maintain energy balance effectively, we wouldn't be gaining so much weight. Our bodies would compensate, either by burning more calories or by shutting down our appetites. Obviously, that is not happening. Over the past decade, scientists have tried to explain this failure by searching for defects in the homeostatic system. Their results have been disappointing. While some genetic and chemical defects have been identified, they seem to be rare and don't adequately account for the most common forms of obesity. Robert De Niro's efforts to gain weight for the movie Raging Bull, and then lose it, demonstrate the limits of the homeostatic system. Hollywood celebrities may not seem to have much in common with the average American, but the extremes to which De Niro had to go for his role gave us experimental information that would have been hard to get another way. First, he gained 60 pounds for the film by loading up on calories, and then he dropped most of that weight. When I asked how he'd been able to do it, De Niro explained that it had been easy to lose the first 35 or 40 pounds. "I stretched the rubber band and let it come back," he said. But the last 20 pounds had been much harder. His body seemed inclined to settle at a weight that was higher than it had been before his gain. Returning to his pre-film weight, De Niro said, had required a vigilant mindset. He likened the process he'd gone through to that of an alcoholic trying to stay sober. Without knowing the biological explanation, De Niro had sensed that the homeostatic system was not acting alone. Despite all the research focused on homeostasis, it is not the only influence on food intake. Researchers have shown that what we eat doesn't depend solely on signals sent by the brain to maintain a stable weight. Another region of the brain, with different circuitry, is also involved, and often it's in charge. This is known as the reward system. And in America, in the fight between energy balance and reward, the reward system is winning. Like the homeostatic system, the body's reward system is essential to survival, encouraging us to seek out pleasurable things like sex and food. Powerful biological forces are at play that make us want something enough to pursue it and then make us feel momentarily better once we obtain it. The anticipation of reward provides motivation to act. Motivational pathways in our brains have developed over the millennia to keep us alive. Activated by stimuli in the environment, they generate an emotional response, which then drives our behavior. In other words, we receive information and we act on it. If the message is, "This is good," we move closer to gain the benefit. If the message is, "This is dangerous," we're likely to withdraw. It is possible to activate the brain's reward centers by artificially stimulating them with an electrode, which is sometimes done during animal experiments. One study showed that when the far lateral hypothalamus region was stimulated, animals ate well beyond the point where they would otherwise have stopped. Another study demonstrated the power of the reward system even more dramatically. Food was placed at the far end of a room with an electrified floor that delivered an unpleasant shock. Animals had to walk across that floor to reach their food. The strength of that shock stopped an animal that hadn't eaten for a while from walking across the floor to obtain food. Under normal circumstances, hunger did not provide enough motive to act, given the consequences. Stimulate the reward centers, though, and the result was just the opposite. Even an animal that wasn't hungry was willing to cross the electrical floor in order to secure a reward. Outside the laboratory, there are other stimulants, of course, and that raises provocative scientific questions. Can they also stir the reward centers of the brain? Is it possible that eating certain foods can stimulate us to keep eating and eating and eating?
Chapter 3. Sugar, fat, and salt make us eat more sugar, fat, and salt.
To understand how eating promotes more eating and why homeostasis is under sustained assault, we must first understand the concept of palatability, as the term is used scientifically. In everyday language, we call food palatable if it has an agreeable taste. But when scientists say a food is palatable, they're referring primarily to its capacity to stimulate the appetite and prompt us to eat more. Palatability does involve taste, of course, but crucially, it also involves the motivation to pursue that taste. It's the reason we want more. Palatability is largely based on how food engages the full range of our senses. Usually the most palatable foods contain some combination of sugar, fat, and salt. The sensory properties of palatable foods, the cold, creamy pleasure of a milkshake, the aroma of chocolate cake, the texture of crispy chicken wings sweetened with a honey mustard dipping sauce, all stimulate the appetite. And it's that stimulation, or the anticipation of that stimulation, rather than genuine hunger, that makes us put food into our mouths long after our caloric needs are satisfied. Palatable foods arouse our appetite, said Peter Rogers, a biological psychologist at the University of Bristol in England. They act as an incentive to eat. Our preference for sweetness is no surprise. Newborns who were given drops of a solution of sucrose and water exhibit pleasure with their facial expressions, and the sweeter the solution, the more they prefer it. Adam Drewnowski at the University of Washington in Seattle has spent 30 years studying human taste, food preferences, and dietary choices. Like many of his colleagues, he initially focused on sugar, but he soon became convinced that sugar itself is not the only reason we're so partial to sweet foods. If nothing else mattered, more of us would just open a packet of sugar and eat it. No one had looked closely at fat until the 1980s. The focus was on the pleasure response to sugar, as though sugar was the only sensation in food that people responded to, said Drewnowski. Certain there was more to the story, he set out to prove it. He found that what we like is not sugar alone, but sugar in combination with fat. Fat, he wrote, is responsible for the characteristic texture, flavor, and aroma of many foods and largely determines the palatability of the diet. Because fat provokes so many different sensations in the mouth, we can't always tell which foods contain the most fat or why we prefer one sugar-fat mixture to another. But we can certainly point to what we like best. Drewnowski conducted a study in which he added various amounts of sugar to 5 different dairy products: skim milk, whole milk, half and half, heavy cream, and heavy cream blended with safflower oil. Skim milk had almost no fat, while the cream and oil mixture contained more than 50% fat. Asked to choose which they liked best, people gave low marks to products with sweetened skim milk, with lots of sugar and little fat, and to unsweetened cream, lots of fat, little sugar. Mix the same amount of sugar into low-fat and high-fat products, however, and people invariably chose the higher-fat mixtures. Fat and sugar levels both influence preference. The Cheesecake Factory knew that back when they were trying to convince David Overton, the chain's founder, to approve a new menu offering. By glazing a chicken dish so that it would pick up extra sweetness, or by cooking beef in extra butter, they gave food enough of a halo effect to win Overton over, recalled one of the research chefs at the chain. The combination of sugar and fat is what people prefer, and it's what they'll eat most. The art of pleasing the palate is in large part a matter of combining them in optimal amounts. That can do more than make food palatable. It can make food hyper-palatable. It is, however, possible to make a food too sweet, too fatty, or too salty. Many of us have what's called a bliss point, the point at which we get the greatest pleasure from sugar, fat, or salt. Scientists depict this as an inverted, U-shaped curve. As more sugar is added, food becomes more pleasurable until we reach the bliss point at the top of the curve, and then the pleasure experience drops off. For sweet beverages, that point is about 10%. Drinks containing more sucrose than that generally taste too sweet, and we enjoy them less. The SALT curve is similar, but steeper, according to food industry expert Dwight Riske, who worked for Frito-Lay. A smaller change in the salt concentration will have a bigger impact than a comparable change in the concentration of sugar, he explained. That's why it's so easy to oversalt food. The bliss point for salt is determined to some extent by the food it's in. We want less salt in soup than we do in potato chips or crackers, for example. The salt level we enjoy may also be determined by what we've learned from our early encounters with food. But when the mix is right, food becomes more stimulating. Eating foods high in sugar, fat, and salt makes us eat more foods high in sugar, fat, and salt. We see this clearly in both animal and human research. Barry Levin, a physician and professor at the New Jersey Medical School, demonstrated this principle with rats. He bred one strain to overfeed when a high-calorie diet was available, producing an obesity-prone rat. The other strain did not ordinarily overfeed, an obesity-resistant rat. After a period of eating extra calories, the obesity-resistant rats typically cut back their food consumption much faster than obesity-prone rats. But when both groups of rats were offered a rich, creamy liquid high in sugar and fat, those patterns changed. All the animals ate without restraint. Levin said that when they're given such a palatable combination, they'll just gorge themselves. Increasing only the fat content of a resistant rat's diet won't make the animal overeat or become obese, but feed it a high-fat, high-sugar diet, and it will grow just as fat as an obesity-prone rat on a high-calorie diet. Variety and ready availability further amplify overeating. Anthony Sclafani was a graduate student at the University of Chicago in the late 1960s when he started trying to understand what promoted excess consumption. When he fed animals high-fat foods, they gained more weight than those fed chow pellets, the bland food that's typically given to laboratory rats, but his results weren't particularly dramatic. Then, by chance, he put a rat on a lab bench near some fallen Fruit Loops, the high-calorie, high-sugar cereal. He was struck by how fast the animal picked up the cereal and started to eat it. Sclafani turned that casual observation into a more formal experiment. After familiarizing test animals with the taste of Fruit Loops, he let them loose in an open field. Rats prefer to stay in corners and won't readily venture across a field to eat chow pellets, but when Fruit Loops were available, they scurried over to them. Next, Sclafani studied the effect of a supermarket diet. The mix of foods he fed his animals could be purchased at any grocery store. Sweetened condensed milk, chocolate chip cookies, salami, cheese, bananas, marshmallows, milk chocolate, and peanut butter. After 10 days, animals that were fed the supermarket diet weighed significantly more than rats that were fed bland chow. And the rats on the supermarket diet continued to gain weight, eventually becoming twice as heavy as their control counterparts. Sclafani concluded that feeding adult rats a variety of highly palatable supermarket foods was a particularly effective way of producing dietary obesity. Why did they keep on eating? What happened to the homeostatic ability to balance energy consumption and expenditure? Why did the rats fail to defend themselves from weight gain? Why did they keep on eating? What happened to the homeostatic ability to balance energy consumption and expenditure? Why did the rats fail to defend themselves from weight gain? Sclafani answered those questions in a single sentence. Quote, "In the normal rat, free access to palatable foods is a sufficient condition to promote excessive weight." Coupled with evidence collected by other scientists, Sclafani's results support the idea that the biological system that's designed to maintain energy balance can go awry when animals have easy access to a variety of foods that are high in sugar and fat. Experiments with humans show much the same thing, especially when they're offered foods they prefer. In one study, participants were asked to keep track of the foods they ate for 7 days and to rate their preference for each meal on a scale of 1 to 7. Most people gave higher ratings to foods with higher levels of fat and sugar. Unsurprisingly, they also ate more of them, consuming almost 44% more food at meals they rated a 7 than at those they rated a 3 or below. In another study, researchers at the National Institutes of Health confined male subjects to a ward in which their food intake could be monitored. For the first few days, the men were fed a diet designed to keep them at their current body weight. Since many of them were significantly overweight, that meant an average of just under 3,000 calories a day. Approximately 50% of those calories came from carbohydrates, 30% from fat, and 20% from protein. The participants were then allowed to eat whatever they wished from two free vending machines that contained a variety of entrees and snacks. This gave them 24-hour-a-day access to meats, cheese, and bread, tortillas and pinto beans, cereal, pastry, and desserts, French fries, popcorn and chips, fruits, vegetables, nuts, and beverages. The men were asked to follow their typical eating patterns as closely as possible. You've probably guessed the result. Given the opportunity to eat without restriction, participants consumed an average of 4,500 calories daily, 150% of what they actually needed to maintain a stable weight. One person consumed almost 7,000 calories, the equivalent of about 17 quarter-pound hamburgers. In general, the study subjects also ate substantially more fat and less protein during the period of unrestricted eating. The typical diet contained 48% carbohydrates, 40% fat, and 12% protein. All of this demonstrates scientifically what most of us know from experience. When offered a varied selection and large portions of high sugar, high fat, high salt foods, many of us will eat them in excessive amounts.
Chapter 4. The Business of Food, Creating Highly Rewarding Stimuli.
Higher sugar, fat, and salt make you want to eat more, a high-level food industry executive told me. I'd already read this in the scientific literature and heard it in conversations with neuroscientists and psychologists. Now an insider was saying the same thing. My source was a leading food consultant, a Henry Ford of mass-produced food, who'd agreed to part the curtain for me, at least a bit, to reveal how his industry operates. To protect his business, he did not want to be identified. But he was remarkably candid, explaining that the food industry creates dishes to hit what he called the three points of the compass. Sugar, fat, and salt make a food compelling, said the consultant. They make it indulgent. They make it high in hedonic value, which gives us pleasure. Do you design foods specifically to be highly hedonic? I asked. Oh, absolutely, he replied without a moment's hesitation. We try to bring as much of that into the equation as possible. During the past two decades, there's been an explosion in our ability to access and afford highly palatable foods. Restaurants, where Americans spend 50% of today's food dollar, sit at the epicenter of this explosion. Countless new foods have been introduced in restaurants, and most of them hit the three points of the compass. Sugar, fat, and salt are either loaded onto a core ingredient, such as meat, vegetable, potato, or bread, layered on top of it, or both. Deep-fried tortilla chips are an example of loading. The fat is contained in the chip itself. When a potato is smothered in cheese, sour cream, and sauce, that's layering. I asked the food consultant to describe the ingredients in some foods commonly found in popular restaurants today. Potato skins, for example. Typically, the potato's hollowed out and the skin is fried, which provides a substantial surface area for what he calls fat pickup. Then some combination of bacon bits, sour cream, and cheese is added. The result is fat on fat on fat on fat, much of it loaded with salt. Cheese fries take a high-fat food and put more fat on top of it, he said. The potato base is a simple carbohydrate, which quickly breaks down to sugar in the body. Once it's fried and layered with cheese, we're eating salt on fat on fat on sugar. Buffalo wings start with the fatty parts of a chicken, which get deep fried. Then they're served with creamy or sweet dipping sauce that's heavily salted. Usually they're par fried at a production plant, then fried again at the restaurant, which essentially doubles the fat. That gives us sugar on salt on fat on fat on fat. Spinach dip is a misnomer. The spinach provides little more than color and a bit of appeal. A high-fat, high-salt dairy product is the main ingredient. It's a tasty dish of salt on fat. Chicken tenders are so loaded with batter and fat that my source jokes that they're a UFO, an unidentified fried object. Salt and sugar are loaded into the fat. The white chocolate mocha frappuccino, served at Starbucks, is coffee diluted with a mix of sugar, fat, and salt. The whipped cream is optional. Bloomin' Onions, the trademark Outback Steakhouse dish, are very popular, and they too provide plenty of surface area to absorb fat. Fried in batter and topped with sauce, their flavor comes from salt on sugar on fat. Salads contain vegetables, of course, but in today's restaurants, they're more than likely to be smothered in a cream-based ranch dressing and flavored with cheese chunks, bacon bits, and oily croutons. The food consultant calls this fat with a little lettuce, although there's salt in the salad as well. Even lettuce has become a vehicle for fat. I began reading the Cheesecake Factory menu to my industry source. He called the chain, known for its vast spaces and equally vast portions, an icon of indulgence. We started with the appetizers. Tex-Mex egg rolls, spicy chicken, corn, black beans, peppers, onions, and melted cheese, served with avocado cream and salsa, I read. The food consultant said the avocado alone is about 15 to 20% fat, and that's before any mayonnaise or heavy cream is loaded in. A fried outer layer wraps fat and salt around more fat. Roadside sliders, bite-sized burgers on mini buns served with grilled onions, pickles, and ketchup. The words suggest a cute little hamburger, but he said there's salt and fat in the meat and sugar and salt in the caramelized onions and the ketchup. In reality, this dish is fat, surrounded by layers of sugar, on salt, on sugar, on salt, making it another grand slam. Chicken pot stickers, Oriental dumplings, pan-fried in the classic tradition, served with our soy dipping sauce. Frying the pot stickers replaces the water in the wrapper with fat. The layer of meat inside is loaded with salt, while the outside layer of sauce is rich with sugar and salt. That's hitting all the points, my source said, sounding almost rueful. Buffalo blasts, chicken breast, cheese, and our spicy buffalo sauce, all stuffed in a spiced wrapper and fried until crisp, served with celery sticks and blue cheese dressing. For a moment, the food consultant just laughed. What can I say? That's fat, sugar, and salt. Chicken breast allows us to suspend our guilt because it suggests a low-fat dish, and the celery sticks also hint at something healthy. But the cheese layer is at least 50% fat and carries a load of salt, and the buffalo sauce adds a layer of sugar on salt. That dough wrapper, a simple carbohydrate, is fried and so absorbent that he called it a fat bomb. Just as chicken becomes the carrier for fat in the buffalo blasts, pizza crust can be a carrier for sugar and fat. Caesar salads are built as an excuse to carry fat and salt. We double-fry French fries, first at the manufacturing plant and then in the restaurant. Our hamburgers are layered with bacon and cheese. We add cheese to spinach, batter our fish before frying it, and slather our Mexican food with cheese. As we do, each one of these foods becomes more compelling, more hedonic, said the consultant. As our conversation wound down, he walked me to the door of his office and paused as if choosing his words carefully. Then, with the certainty of an insider, he observed that the food industry is the manipulator of the consumer's minds and desires.
Chapter 5. Pushing Up Our Settling Points.
For years, I wondered why I was fat. Science seemed to suggest it was my destiny. Set point theory says that adult weight is destined to remain at a predetermined level and that we will adjust our energy intake and output to keep it there. According to set point theory, I was fat because my body's thermostat was set high. The capacity to compensate for either inadequate or excess food intake reflects the homeostatic system in action. The theory is that if I lose weight, my body tries to get it back, slowing down my metabolism until I return to my predetermined set point. That made homeostasis a useful way to explain the failure of diets. But if the set point worked, it should not only defend me against weight loss, it should also protect me from weight gain. When I eat more, my body should theoretically be compensating by speeding up my metabolism to burn more energy, but it does not. To understand what has pushed up weight curves over the past few years, it is more useful today to think instead about the body's settling point. The settling point theory goes beyond homeostatic mechanisms to make room for a number of independent influences on weight. A somewhat more nuanced model, it's built on the idea that weight is not set at a predetermined level, but is determined by a balance of many factors. On the appetite side, the drive to eat and the capacity to be satisfied are primary. On the expenditure side, the major factors are the ability to oxidize fat and burn calories, along with the level of physical activity. The settling point is the place where all this comes to equilibrium. I hypothesize that the point where our weight settles is primarily the result of motivation and availability. How much we want to seek out food and how readily we can obtain and eat it. In the short term, we may be able to restrict our eating, lose weight, and reach a new settling point. But if we return to earlier patterns and familiar environments, we will pursue reward with renewed vigor, gain weight, and return to the old settling point. That's why diets fail. Constant access to sugar plus fat, salt plus fat, and sugar plus fat plus salt pushes up the settling point. We move along the weight curve because the body's furnace is not burning quite enough fuel to keep pace with our energy intake. Eventually, the upward spiral ends as we reach our capacity to increase consumption in response to sensory stimuli, but by then, our weight has settled in a very different zone. This is by no means a universal response. Food loaded with fat and sugar asserts its hold, its capture, on each of us with varying intensity. Some respond with indifference. Others are able to eat just a little and then stop. But for the millions of people whose attention it grabs, the drive for reward aggressively asserts dominance over the drive for balance. It's not our biological destiny to return to a set point. That reward drive can become an obsession, although it's one that many people keep private. Take, for example, my colleague Claudia's response to frozen chocolate peanut butter cookies. She calls them Charlie cookies, and they're one of her favorite desserts. In addition to chocolate chips and peanut butter, they contain relatively few ingredients. Just oats, corn syrup, brown sugar, butter or margarine, vanilla, and salt. In effect, the oats serve as the binder for what is otherwise nothing more than three kinds of sweeteners, plus fat and salt, topped with a frosting of semi-sweet chocolate chips and peanut butter. One day I spotted Claudia walking down the hallway with a plate of them, and I asked her to describe their appeal. "The chocolate smell is very distracting," she said. "I keep looking at them and thinking how good it would taste to have a bite. My stomach is starting to react. The back of my tongue tingles." Claudia knows from the past exactly how she'll experience the first bite of that frozen cookie. It takes only a few chews for the chocolate peanut butter layer to melt. As it does, the flavor goes from a cold, concentrated spot on my tongue to very warm and mushy, a salty, sweet, liquidy mush that seems to fill my entire mouth. That combination of texture and taste works its magic. Claudia knows it takes about 15 bites to consume most of the cookie and another half dozen chews to swallow the lingering bits of oats and chocolate. "I'm very conscious of the complexity of the chewing process," she says. "As more pieces of the cookie melt, all the flavors combine and more flavor is released at the back of my mouth." Claudia ate two of the cookies as she continued her vivid, sensual description. "The flavor is actually most potent after I've already swallowed the bite. It just makes me want to eat more to combine the pleasure of the flavor with the pleasure of the act of chewing and eating and swallowing." The sight, the smell, the taste, and the texture of those cookies all captivated Claudia. Only her auditory sense was not engaged. It was a mere cookie, but to Claudia and others like her, it emitted a strong emotional charge. I brought together a cross-section of colleagues to talk about their reactions to fats and sugars. Claudia and Maria, who are both overweight, were willing to join. Rosalita and Jacob, who are thin, also came along. Earlier, I'd asked them to name their favorite snacks. Now I opened up the packages they'd identified. Little Debbie's Swiss rolls, peanut butter M&Ms, and a Snickers bar, and displayed them on the table. I asked them to share the thoughts running through their heads as they sat around that table. Maria, who was partial to the cake rolls, began to describe them in the language of the senses. "Creaminess and moistness," she said. "I see their contours. The shape is perfect for a bite. I imagine how they'll feel in my mouth. Sweet, but not too sweet." The aroma of the chocolate and cream blend appealed to her as well. "I just want to reach over and grab them and take a bite," she sighed. As she talked, I could almost see her desire. Before I unwrapped the snacks, Maria said she'd not been thinking about food and she hadn't felt hungry. But now she felt compelled to stare at the cake and to imagine it in her mouth. She knew she wouldn't be able to resist for long. "I keep looking at it," she admitted. "The outside coating is delicious. I'm fooling myself by thinking that I'll eat only one." Suddenly Maria became angry. "I do not want them," she said, "but I cannot control my desire to eat them. I'm obsessing. I feel totally out of control." The struggle taking place in Maria's brain is one familiar to many of us. I felt that a scientific understanding of what Maria and others like her were experiencing emotionally might begin to make a difference to millions of Americans. Claudia had much the same emotional response. Her obsession with Charlie cookies was rivaled only by her full-tilt focus on the Snickers bar. She kept thinking about that candy. Like Maria, she wasn't hungry, but she felt completely distracted by the chocolate bar and couldn't stop looking at it. "I feel very wanton, as if I don't have control over myself, my impulses," she told us. "If I were alone, I'd eat it in a flash." Only our presence in the room held her back. "I'm not going to eat this in front of any of you," she said, "but I know I'm going to eat it, even though I don't want to. It's a done deal. I'll eat the whole thing." With those words, Claudia's anxiety about deciding whether to eat the candy bar had passed. She told me she had felt jittery as I unwrapped it, and indeed I noticed she had nervously tapped her fingers on the table. She said she expected to feel disgusted after eating the candy, but right now she was calm. "I'm not anxious because it's only a matter of time before I eat it," she explained. "The hard part of arguing with myself is over. Before and after is when I feel awful, tormented." Rosalita spoke next. Although thin, she obsesses about food as much as the others. She told me she'd already eaten some chocolate earlier in the day and 4 cookies the previous evening. She commented on the appealing